Один.
Back in the USSR, every Saturday from 9 to 11 p.m., revolution takes over the airwaves. You're listening to Back in the USSR. God created rich people first, and then showed them the world they would own. And when they came to a field with thousands of headless bodies with torsos and hands like iron, God told them that the headless bodies were destined to be poor workers. The rich cried out, "But these heroes, with their iron muscles, will crush us. Don't be frightened," answered God. "I shall place very small heads and brains on their bodies, so until they develop them, you have nothing to fear." Who are still the oppressors? The rich. Who are still the oppressed? The poor. Your slavery is their liberty. Your poverty is their prosperity. Priests say the poor must be content with their poverty and they'll find heaven hereafter. Idiots. Cretinous rag pickers. My dog Georges has more sense. Don't you know that whilst you're gazing up at heaven, your pockets are being picked clean, your eyes are plucked out, and you're robbed of your birthright, blind to what is done to you? Christ's priest seized mankind in its cradle and broke the bad news, saying, "You shapeless stench, you can never be but anything but filth. Your only chance of winning a pardon for being so filthy is if you bow low in perfect humility in the face of all the afflictions, sorrows, and injustices heaped upon you. You're poor, and you stay poor. That is how it is meant to be. Life is a bitter ordeal. Don't speak out. Just try and save your worthless soul. You won't be able to, but you'll give us less trouble by trying. And when the time comes for you to die, croaking, the darkness will be as hard to bear as the daylight ever was, so." The church knows its business. It offers fear and punishment, not happiness, certainly not liberty, only servitude forever and forever. Religion is a liar and a cheat. Yet still you hunger for it. That's why you've sent for me, Jacques Roux, Mad Jacques, Red Roux, preacher of the poor, sower of sedition, subverter of all laws, a priest who saw the light of reason and now proclaims fellowship with all who live in dark dens and desolate places. It's fitting that I should preach perhaps my last sermon in a ruined church in the parish of St. Nicholas, summer's end. I go before the tribunal tomorrow, charged with revolutionary excess. Now I am, it seems, too revolutionary for the revolution. And so it begins. When power rested in one man, King Louis, all sorts complained of oppression, and the nobility, middle, and moneyed men called on the poor to help. Together, we lopped off that top branch of tyranny, but the tree still stands and spreads. New branches hide the sun of freedom from the poor. The Revolutionary Tribunal is one such. I don't recognize its authority to judge me. Only the poor of St. Nicholas can do that. I come here to lay the rags and tatters of my life before my peers. Habits are hard to break, citizens. I come to confess me. Hear my confession. Do not forgive me, Father, for I have not sinned. My own father had 12 children, and as I was the cleverest, he rid himself of me by sending me to school at the Angoulême Seminary. At 15, I was ordained a priest, when I knew even less about God than I know now. There was a priest on every dunghill. The scummier they were, the more they sprouted. But I stayed on and became a professor of philosophy, teaching students to bear with fortitude the misfortunes of others. Like religion, philosophy solves the problems of the past and the future, never the present. In 79, the Angoulême students rioted over the agony they saw around them and killed a cook by accident. As a suspect teacher with ideas, I was arrested and imprisoned, though I had nothing to do with the incident. A month or so later, I was released. No trial, no inquiry, authority had decreed it, and I had no say in the matter whether I was to be free or in chains. This is how fires are kindled. Afterwards, I spent 4 years in the chair of experimental medicine in Angoulême, but medicine proved equally useless. Physicians know even less than philosophers and priests gangrene together. They lie. They all lie. Isn't that so, Georges? You tell them. I've grown hoarse in the telling. In 89, I was given this poor parish of St. Nicholas, and I was born into the real world of starvation and misery, and I saw the horror and the hope, too, for the revolution burst over us, smashed the clamps that held us down and swept us up. Up with its transforming power, we opened the book we'd never read, and on the first page was the word liberty. Listen. Listen, the revolution was born in violence. Revolutions must be violent. It is the only way to end the greater violence that keeps the majority of mankind in servitude. Do you think that those with privileges would give them up without a fight because you have a charming smile or the best arguments? Adjuro. Adjuro. I renounced my alliance to Rome and gave it to France. I became a constitutional priest, put off the mitered robes of privilege and put on the white robes of liberty. I still practice as a priest and physician when called on, but I have to earn an honest living as a pamphleteer and municipal official. I live with a good woman, widow petted, born Elizabeth Hubert, once laundress to the rich, now my helpmate, soulmate, who sells my pamphlets 2 sous a copy. We adopted a son, Emile, a sweet, sweet boy. No more of that. It's not for your ears, all yours, all yours. My only fear, citizens, is not death, but a life without them. George knows. We love them, don't we, George, eh? I was elected a member of the commune and spoke for the poor. I told Robespierre, Saint-Just, Brissot, and the rest that they could never be the revolution. Just men, and not to be trusted with power. Anyone with authority becomes an oppressor, a parasitic coat of filth on the hide of common people. Between those who command and those who obey, there is only hate. Does it follow that I reject all authority? No, but I always keep my hat on in its presence. In the matter of bread, I consult a baker. In the matter of boots, a bootmaker. A house, a builder. For special knowledge, I apply to a specialist. But I don't allow the baker, the bootmaker, or builder to impose their authority over me. I listen to them with the respect they merit, if any, but I keep the right to judge, criticize, and censure. Why should we treat politicians of whatever stripe, royal or revolutionary, any different? I listen to King Louis, Mirabeau, Lafayette the same way I listen to the baker and the bootmaker. Don't be fooled by those who set themselves above you. Always look at the bill they are presenting. You have to pay it. And criticize me too. People thought Citizen Mara and I were enemies because we were forever attacking each other. He called me an extremist, this from a man who declared 300,000 heads weren't enough. But we were never enemies, just revolutionaries doing our duty. Neither of us were popular with the legislators. But it is not my purpose to be popular. I am here to sting. To stop me stinging, the assembly hired me to write the report of the king's execution. We didn't do that well. But you'll not squeeze one tear from my eye over the fate of a royal fool and his followers who talked of honor and died without it. To the boneyard with the whole crew. The rich we'll gobble up, tra-lee, tra-la, tra-lie, with truffles in the rump and oysters on each eye. I love the harp. That's how men and women should die. To the sound of harps. They're so precious. King Louis died to the sound of drums. As the recording officer, I went with Citizen Santerre to the temple prison to escort the king to the place of execution. Santerre brought a carriage and a guard of honor for the occasion. We drove through streets lined with citizens. They had 3 executions waiting, 3, and 18 drummers. What extravagance just to kill one man. The knife fell. Louis's head fell with it. The crowd shouted, "Long live the Republic!" And then I saw Citizen Santerre and the other revolutionary officials dipping their handkerchiefs in the king's blood. I wrote it all up in my report, but I was the only one who seemed disgusted by the whole spectacle. Invading armies were about to overwhelm Paris, there was civil strife in the Vendée, rebellions in Lyon and Bordeaux, and good men and women were dying everywhere defending the revolution, even as the traitorous Louis was dying on the scaffold. But the good and true had no carriages, no 18 drummers and 3 executioners, a Prussian sword in the belly and an English bullet in the chest, and falling face down in the mud was their end. That's how ordinary people die. Meanly. Without harps or even drums to play them out. But Louis, that useless toe rag of a man, goes in style, his anemic blood gathered up as something precious. A month later, remember, I led the attack on the Paris food merchants. I'm proud of that attack. Those in power condemn me for it, so I know it must have been right. We ask only for food. A home, a little ease, no more crying in the streets, bread, bread for God's sake. We were at war, and so we accepted such hardships if they were equally shared, but they weren't. We were dying because of filthy bourgeois graft and greed. The slimy, rapacious, money-mad exploiters were hoarding food to raise the price on the open market. Our legislators wrung their heads, threatened with a whisper, and did nothing. So we flat bellies marched, smashed stalls, broke open shops and warehouses, and found the bread and meat and the other foodstuffs they had hidden in abundance. They asked us why we did it. We told them because we needed it. Citizen Mara said we should kill every merchant in sight. We may do with a few scores strung up in front of their own shops to encourage the others, and it did. The next morning, the food markets were filled again with fruit and vegetables, bread and meat. Like Jesus, we had performed the miracle of the loaves and fishes. We must appropriate the land and money from the rich who have it in excess and give it to those who need it and live in want. The only way to defend and save the revolution is by pushing it as far as it'll go and then further. Then that's never enough for me. Then Citizen Marat died, steel through the heart, painless when he had such a painful life. I miss him. No one left to trust. That's why I agreed to become editor of his paper when his staff asked me to keep the bright flame burning. So when those impotent, excremental conformists Robespierre and the Jacobin gang banned women from political power, we took up the cause. They wanted liberty for themselves alone. I wrote that those refugees from the leper house of reaction should be belled and booted headfirst into the nearest sewer. In return, they persuaded Mara's widow, Catherine, to denounce me to the Revolutionary Tribunal for besmirching her husband's memory. Poor sweet Catherine. Grief takes many forms. She wanted to protect her husband's fame. She thought I was trying to take it from him in some way. I shun fame. It always costs too much. Late last night, I went walking through the streets of Paris with Georges. Just the two of us. Georges padding beside me, sniffing every post and doorway, and me smoking my pipe. There's nothing better. Making love, perhaps. Or making a revolution. But with revolution, you have to be right. It was a clear night. In empty streets. And as we passed St. Nicholas Church, something strange happened. I was walking. But suddenly I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Not one. Silence. I was a dead man walking. No more of that. Tomorrow before the tribunal of mumblers, I shall make no attempt to defend myself. That doesn't mean to say I'll stay silent. Never that. I'll do what I was born to do. Attack. If the verdict of that bunch of rotting fish heads goes against me, I'll die like friend Mara, being, though struck down by a better hand, my own. It's been a rich confession after all, friends, deserving of some penance. At least 5 Hail Marys and 26 Amens. After all, I've preached revolution and sedition, slaughtered a king and others, lived in sin, and will probably end even deeper in it by killing myself. In the eyes of the church, it is 100% record of failure. But on Judgment Day, I expect to stand before my God justified. I do not condemn myself and shall not be condemned. And so, amen. If it's to be the last amen, I go gladly. My wife and son will weep, I know. Georges here will howl a little, won't you, boy? My friends will pause, shake their heads, and move on. For they have the difficult part. Living well is so much harder than dying well. I have tried to help create a people who are skeptical, rational, critical, not easily fooled or impressed, in a word, a free people. Ungovernable. It's a dream, of course, but I've been lucky enough to have lived through times that made the dream seem possible. And just for a moment, we stop being me and mine, you and yours, us and them. We saw ourselves instead as equals in our common humanity. We are of that generation that so transformed the world that future days and nights can never be the same. We poor, clumsy men and women turn the world upside down, inside out, round and about. One last word from my last sermon. The revolution isn't complete, hardly begun. Defend it. Don't sit back, act. Without action, no life. Without life, no perfection. Without perfection, no eternal peace and freedom. For God is an active power, and we do his work in fighting the great battles. Light against darkness. Love against selfishness. Revolution against reaction. Life against death. Come on, George. Time for our walk.
You could look at any existing socialist country, if you don't want to call them socialists, call them whatever you want, post-capitalist, whatever, I don't care, call them camels, window shades, doesn't matter, as long as we know the countries we're talking about. You can look at any one of those countries, and you can evaluate them in several ways. One, comparing them to what they had before. And that, to me, is what's very compelling. That's what's so compelling about Cuba, for instance. When I was in Cuba, I was up in the Escambray, which is like the Appalachia of Cuba, very rugged mountains, the poor people, very poor if they were. And I said to this campesino, I said, do you like Fidel? And he says, si, with all our souls. I remember his gesture, with all our souls. I said, why? And he pointed to this clinic right up there on the hill, which we had visited. He said, look at that. He said, before the revolution, we never saw a doctor. If someone was seriously ill, it would take 20 people to carry that person. Because you'd go day and night. It would take 2 days to get to the hospital. First, because it was far away, and second, because you couldn't go straight. You couldn't cross the latifundio lands. The boss would kill you. So you had to go like this. And often when we got to the hospital, the person might be dead by the time we got there. Now we have this clinic up here with a full-time doctor. And today, a doctor in Cuba, when you become a doctor, you've got to spend 2 years out in the country. That's your dedication to the people. And a dentist who comes 1 day a week. And for more serious things, we're not more than 20 minutes away from a larger hospital. That's in the Escambray. So that's freedom. We're freer today. We have more life. And I talked to a guy in Havana who says to me, before, all I used to see here in Havana, you call this drab and dull. We see it as a cleaner city. It's true. You got the paint is peeling off the walls, but you don't see kids begging in the streets anymore. And you don't see prostitutes. All we used to have was prostitutes. Prostitution used to be one of the biggest industries. And today, this man is going to night school. He said, I can read. I can read. Do you know what it means to be able to read? Do you know what it means to be able not to read? I remember when I gave my book to my father, I dedicated a book of mine, Power and the Powerless, to my father. I said, to my father with my love. Gave him a copy of the book. He opened it up, looked at that. He'd only gone to the seventh grade. He was a son of an immigrant, a working class Italian, and he opens the book and he starts looking through it and he gets misty-eyed, very misty-eyed. And I thought it's because he was so touched that his son had dedicated a book to him. That wasn't the reason. He looks up to me and says, I can't read this, kid. I said, that's okay, Dad, neither can the students. I mean, that's not something, I mean, don't worry about that. I wrote it for you. I mean, it's your book and you don't have to read it. You know, it's a very complicated book, academic book. I can't read this book. And the defeat that man felt. That's what illiteracy is about. That's what the joy of literacy programs is. That's why in Nicaragua you got people walking proud now for the first time. They were animals before. They weren't allowed to read. They weren't taught to read. So you compare a country to what it came from with all its imperfections. And those who demand instant perfection, the day after the revolution, they get up and say, are there civil liberties for the fascists? Are they going to be allowed to have their newspapers and their radio program? Are they going to be able to keep all their farms? The passion that some of our liberals feel, the day after the revolution, the passion and concern they feel for the fascists, the civil rights and civil liberties of those fascists who were dumping and destroying and murdering people before. Now the revolution has got to be perfect. It's got to be flawless. Well, that isn't my criteria. My criteria is what happens to those people who couldn't read. What happens to those babies that couldn't eat, that died of hunger? And there, that's why I support revolution. The revolution that feeds the children gets my support. Not blindly, not unqualified. And the Reaganite government that tries to stop that kind of process, that tries to keep those people in poverty and illiteracy and hunger, that gets my undiluted animosity and opposition.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. Hope you'll pardon me for my somewhat unorthodox introduction this week. But it's a bit of a difficult occasion for me. You know, Siegfried, who of course has hosted this show for 6 years. We've come to the end. Brothers and sisters, this is the last show I'll be doing here on CFRU. And that's a difficult thing for me to really process in my mind. Something that's been such a part of me, of who I am, for that period of time, like since 2010. And it's coming to an end now. Something which just started out as just a simple experiment. You know, experimental music show dealing with music from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union has become something so much greater. Greater in the sense that, well, even though I may still be a communist island in a capitalist sea, I've established a real presence for ideas and positions that have been marginalized to the point of most people forgetting about them or forgetting what they really mean. And I've tried to explain in my own imperfect way concepts such as socialism. Socialism means what communism means, what national liberation means, what anti-colonialism means, what anti-imperialism means. And on the flip side, of course, what things like, you know, destructive things like capitalism mean, and what imperialism means, what colonialism mean, what all these things mean. The understanding of which is absolutely crucial if you want to understand what's going on in the world, really at all. And of course, we're not taught those things. You know, we're lucky if we get through school and we've picked up a real working knowledge of any of those things in this country. Certainly I was lucky to have a high school teacher, civics teacher, and then a history teacher who was himself a Marxist and was himself Mohawk. So he knew a thing or two about what colonialism meant and what it meant to fight against colonialism and empire and what those things really meant. They weren't abstract terms to him. They were all too real. And seeing, of course, what did he do? He did something that was practically unheard of in a civics classroom. He showed a video on the Oka crisis of 1990 when, of course, the Canadian Armed Forces surrounded and besieged the Mohawk Reservation by Montreal, surrounded it with tanks and barbed wire for weeks on end. And really showed the iron fist of colonialism that usually is hidden in this country by a velvet glove of propaganda and political platitudes. And this is a class of mostly white suburban kids who are not going to learn this any other way. They have to actually see it with their own eyes. And he tried to do that, once again in his own imperfect way. Tried to get people to understand. Tried to get his students to understand. These very important things that make the world, that really define the world that we live in. And in many cases, there are horrific things. Things that we habitually turn away from, because they are so horrific, and they penetrate those illusions we like to tell ourselves and surround ourselves with about the real nature of the world that we live in. And the more I live, the older I get in this country, the more and more I see just how much this country is a house of cards. So many lies, so many deceptions, all overlaying this cold reality of genocide, colonization, of indigenous land. And over top of that, we have, you know, Justin Trudeau, latest example of the apologist for colonialism. You know, making appearances at rock concerts, at pride parades, virtually every public event you can think of where you can get a decent photo op and reassure people that everything's okay and all is well with the world. This country is pathetically backward in terms of political change. I mean, geez, even the United States has Bernie Sanders. Even the UK has Jeremy Corbyn. As deficient as those people are, as non-revolutionary as they are, they still represent a shift in political realities in those countries. They represent a shift of people turning away from the status quo, from the mainstream. In Canada, you see no such shift. We're still stuck in this complacent mindset, this idea that we're somehow exempt. Canada is somehow exceptional, and that it rises above everything in the world. Somehow it's this isolated kind of floating thing. And anyone who lives here has immunity. Now, of course, Indigenous people will tell you that is bullshit. As are most African Canadians and a lot of people of color in this country. But there's way too many people who have the luxury of believing the lies that Canadian nationalism really tells us. And that's held us back. Even further back than the United States and the UK, from developing ourselves and advancing any alternatives to the present status quo. In the last election, the Canadian electorate did, frankly, the expected. They're dissatisfied with the Conservatives. They vote in the Liberals. Same old, same old. We've seen that again and again. For the last more than 100 years. And we just see more of it. And of course, there are people hurting for real in this country. We see poverty, we see racism, we see exploitation, we see violence. But it's like so many of us are like off in La La Land. They don't see any of it. They're blind to it. They just see what they want to see. And that is very painful, painful to witness. I know that when I go to China, I'm going to a country that, frankly, understands that it lives in the real world. There isn't this large percentage of the population that lives in la-la land in China. They don't come from a history of settler colonialism. In fact, they come from a legacy of resistance to colonialism. And that is such a part of who they are. I know that when I walk into a Chinese classroom, as I will, in my role as a teacher, and when I walk into that classroom and I tell them a little bit about my country, when I tell them about the resistance of indigenous people in this country to colonialism, their experience, the experience of the Inuit people now dealing with global warming, a problem they did not create, but which on top of everything else they must now face, I know that they'll believe me. They'll understand it. They won't try to say I'm exaggerating anything. They're not trying to, they don't think I have an agenda. They understand what happens to indigenous people in North America because they've understood, they've experienced similar things themselves. They've been on the receiving end of imperialism themselves. Meanwhile, of course, you walk into a class of white students in this country. Many of them have great difficulty wrapping their heads around just the concept that powerful forces motivated by the acquisition of wealth and power could be so ruthless in so many areas of the world. From the time of Columbus to the present day, students in China have no trouble understanding that. They understand why China, the socialist state in China, must be strong. Why it has to maintain a strong army and defend itself now that it's being encircled by U.S. bases throughout the Pacific Ocean and in Central Asia. They understand what they're up against. They've seen it before. And no one over there deludes themselves that the United States, with its aggressive moves, is acting from humanitarian impulses and such nonsense. In a way, it will be incredibly cathartic. Leaving this place, leaving this floating world called Canada, a place I was born into, and I've had to navigate. Because, of course, when you leave Canada, when you leave settler states, it's very easy to recognize just how horrifically exceptional they are. The vast majority of places in the world are completely different. The vast majority of places in the world are, frankly, normal. Places like Canada, the United States, Australia. These places built on conquered land, they're the places that are abnormal. And abnormal in a very horrific way. But I understand I have to come back, and I will come back. I can't forsake this land. no matter how much it frustrates me sometimes. I'll have to come back and play my role, whatever role I have, in trying to build a new reality here. That secures justice and power for working class people, for proletarians, and for oppressed nationalities, and racialized people, and for women, and for people who have been marginalized on gender grounds. You know, all these people in need of liberation. So much to be done. There's so much to be done all around the world. And here, on this humble radio show that I've maintained for the last 6 years, I'm just happy that some of you have listened to me.
Villainous. Life. Peacehood. Yo. I light my candles under St. Anthony, burning rosemary for friends and families, for those buried, for all humanity and souls heavy. Ride through life like an old Chevy, look at the world through your rear view, and honk your horn till they hear you. So after you're gone, it's tribute for all the pain that you lived through. Rainstorms are now clear blue, a king's gone on your mirror. Wings formed in the spiritual, the ritual for those we long. Here's my tears in the tissue. I opened it, look how they turn to diamonds. Children reflection, such you still shining. The worldly body had to do some dying. Transformation, so I leave this here with the plants of fragrance. Before you roam the land of the ancient, my mind's an enigma filled with broken pictures. The spiritual stuff can see clearer now. Just listen to me, to me. Just listen to me, me. Just listen to me, to me. Just listen to me.
Light up a cigar, let the aroma reach her. It's like the smile on the Mona Lisa, holding a child that rose on Easter. Like a cloud passing over Giza. Pick the style of my older teachers. Through a cloud when he blow his cheaper. This weed storm glasses on, then it rains down on my people. I see Sean Vaughn walking through walls. See Mark Spark floating through halls. Tommy Rock coming through floors. Fresh continued grief in my heart. When I speak in the dark, I weep in the park. The spirit departs. A mark, lyrically sharp, a shock. From the roots to the trunk to the bark. This is my art, this is my art. I'm Noah Jonah. Farewell, I sail from the Nox, which is the holy body. Stained glass paragraph. Preparation of the gospel of peace. Apostle on beast, colossal on streets. Staring at the walls till the walls became a door. The door opened, before me was a great ocean. And a throne with my two sides, my omens and my chosen. Better side, I let it fly from hell arise. Mesmerized by the enterprise, starship mega size. God lives when I'm hypnotized. Project flip the slide. I start climbing out this hellhole as the souls go.
Just listen to me, to me. Just listen to me, me. Just listen to me, to me. Just listen to me.
There's no eye like understanding. There's no blindness like ignorance. Better than a young man's knowledge is an old man's experience. There's no evil than sickness. Nothing so dreaded as death. What's the hill but forgiveness? Pride before fall. Look inside myself and did some cleansing. Drop my defenses. Begin to rinse in. Tonight a lion sleeps in the heart of every brave man. Like a cave in the African land. The immaculate stand to inhabit what's grand. Above is the black poison clouds. You only got one life, so enjoy it now. And cherish the day before you perish away. We all inherit the grave. These are the letters that say, together we pray, heaven's amazed. Shed tears in my silver offering bowl. Incense burn patchouli smoke for the lost souls at the fork in the road.
So, just listen to me. Just listen to me. Just listen to me. Just listen to me, me, me.
Just listen to me. Just listen to me. Just listen to me. Just listen to me.
Who am I? What am I? And perhaps most importantly, why am I? Eternal questions that humanity shall never be free of, and which will surely tear me limb from limb. I am human, but I live in a society where a history of utter barbarism has caused me to be defined by the color of my skin. Granted the esteemed privilege of being considered officially human by the powers that be, whilst others must struggle for that recognition from the day they are born until the day that they die. No respite, no mercy, ever screaming to be heard until their voice gives out. And yet I was stamped with an official seal of approval from birth, groomed to be a compliant, dependable servant of the status quo in peace, and a sacrificial lamb in times of war. Oh, how human. Oh, so human. To be colonially inhuman. They tell me I am free. They tell me that I'm lucky. Oh, so very lucky to live in this blessed, peaceful, and once again lucky land, whose blood-drenched history I didn't even have to know. I chose this. I chose consciousness. I chose awareness. I chose to see everything from the thefts, the land grabs, the starvation, the murders, the genocide, the residential schools, the mines, the pipelines, the slums, the pollution, the forcible erasure of whole peoples. The iron fist within the velvet glove, just as it was at Oka in August 1990 when the Mohawk people stood their ground upon their own land, even though they were staring down the gun barrels of Canadian government tanks, an occupying army on stolen land. And all the while, people of my skin tone were being treated to a made-for-TV event 12 time zones away, basking in our righteousness as we cheered on those oh-so-brave, democracy-loving people in Tiananmen Square standing against the tanks of a despotic communist regime. Good and evil had never been so picture-perfect. I mean, we were so disappointed. So disappointed, those of us who even bothered to notice, to find out it was all a sham. So disappointed when WikiLeaks belatedly broke the truth that there had been no bloodshed in Tiananmen Square at all, and that all the sensationalized headlines and impassioned rhetoric was just an attempt to displace North American sins onto Asians. But in the end, who cared, right? Canadians never bothered to listen to Chinese truth any more than they bothered to listen to the truth of Indigenous people in their own country. Canadians see what they want to see. That's why they still insist that Passchendaele and Vimy Ridge, alongside other horrific episodes in the killing fields of World War I, were noble exploits in the cause of human freedom and national self-determination. What's so noble about being ordered to advance to your own destruction into an indefensible bog, drowning in mud? What is so virtuous in loyally following the orders of a colonial empire, busily herding its youth forward as cannon fodder for its imperial ambitions and globalized profits? Like so many tools to be used, abused, and discarded. Disposable. Expendable units to be shot, gassed, drowned, blown to smithereens, reduced to babbling lunatics sinking into the mire of the Western Front. Oh, how glamorous. Such a fitting sacrifice to the generals, financiers, and arms merchants in whose name our nation was founded. A glorious little colony bleeding for the mother country. I'm leaving for China soon. And yes, as a communist, I'll be glad to be in a country where I can proudly place my political affiliations on a resume and be seen as something other than a kook and a ne'er-do-well. I'll be glad to be in a place where I can openly be myself and where concepts like human rights mean more than words on paper or endless commission reports and Justin Trudeau's smile. When the Chinese say they want to end homelessness, they actually build houses. When the Chinese say they want to combat climate change, they actually have... They actually have a green energy infrastructure plan on it, develop it on a countrywide scale. Imagine that. When the Chinese say they want to end poverty, they actually build schools, hospitals, railways, industries. It doesn't matter what region it's in or if it's profitable or not. When the Chinese say they want a nation-to-nation relationship with indigenous peoples, they mean indigenous education in indigenous languages, indigenous self-government, and indigenous economic development. In China, there are no reservations. And the 55 non-Chinese ethnic groups have rights that an indigenous person in Canada can only dream of having. The West is so smug when it calls out Free Tibet. When a Tibetan can go to school up to and including university in their own language, while a Canadian must travel to the Sorbonne in Paris if they even wanted to study the language of the Inuit people. Is it so hard to believe that all these hundreds of millions of people the UN says have been lifted out of poverty in the last 20 years have overwhelmingly been in communist China rather than northern Canada? Which of these two countries is the true prison house of nations? In going to other countries, one quickly sees just how abnormal colonialism is. I am a communist. I volunteered. I chose this. I chose awareness. I chose consciousness. I chose real history over lies. I chose real knowledge over ignorance and bigotry. I chose real facts over common assumptions. I chose action over words. And I have learned to claim no easy victories. In fact, I don't expect you to believe anything I've said. You can dismiss my words. You can turn your back. You can forget I ever spoke to you. You can deny everything I've said and scream out loud that it is not the truth. But it is the truth. It is real. And no amount of denial on your part